Hi, everybody. It's Jim Beek Guy. Podcast is Be You, The World Will Adjust. Really, really excited to have Stephen Harrington, a partner at Deloitte, who talks and works on future skills and works with companies about the future. I'm so excited to have you here, Stephen. But before I get to your work, I always like to know about people. So tell me about you. Where were you born and raised, family, school, and stuff like that?
Well, Jim, I was born in Winnipeg. I didn't hang around for very long, though. When I was six, we moved to Ontario, and we ended up living on a farm. I grew up a farm boy, raised cattle and pigs, and actually, I was seriously into horses. I remember telling my mother, I know what I'm going to do when I'm done high school. I'm going to train horses. And she said, that's great. Where are you going to live? So that began my university career. I actually began in literature and philosophy before I found business, and have since done my MBA and ended up, thankfully, at a firm like Deloitte, where you have the time and space to not only help clients, but think about things like the future of work and apply it to the real world.
What was your first inclination of, because, you know, I'm all about true fit, finding your true fit, maximizing your skills, working on the things that you're good at. So because I want this to be two lessons for people, I want it to be one lesson about a great example of someone finding their passion and their true fit and going after it and really expanding on it. But how did you come about it? How did it all begin for you?
I mean, if I go back to that literature and philosophy background, what I initially thought was I'll be a professor. I went to Trent University. And if you know those small universities, what's incredible about them is you were just working hand in glove with the professors every day, small classroom. That's what I thought being a professor was. And then I went and I did my master's in a much larger university. And I realized, oh, wait a minute, this isn't for me. But, you know, in a funny way, Jim, that curiosity about humans, that curiosity about why we're here and what we're doing, led me to ask myself some pretty deep questions about work. Why do we value it the way we do? Why do we think that going to work from 9 to 5 is as valuable as we think it is? And I began to question those things, which I was able to do at Deloitte. I never would have thought that, but when I joined in my very first year, I just stumbled into a project where the HR Professionals Association at the time came to us and said, hey, we want to write this paper about the future of work. I got tapped because of my research background, and you know, 10 years have passed since that moment. I couldn't have told you before that moment that this was going to be the thing. And isn't that funny? That's how it works.
It's one of those things that's, you know, Katie and I talk about this intersection of serendipity all the time. And is it coincidence or is it not coincidence? Well, and you were, if I read correctly, started around 2011, 2010. So, I mean, it must be mind-blowing to be sitting here today and what's happened in the last 18 months. It must feel like you were going about 5 miles an hour and then all of a sudden someone hit the accelerator, where you probably went from having to try to convince people of what you were talking about to now the other way, that you're in incredible demand for people because they're lost, right?
Yeah, no, it's a fair point, Jim. Nobody saw COVID coming. I mean, I predicted a lot of things, but I did not predict that. But it has acted as an accelerator for a lot of these issues. There's sort of three big questions that we're asking and answering these days. And one is, what's the next normal going to look like when COVID's over? Are people going to go back to the way things were before? Or will there be some hybrid? What impact is that going to have on the way we organize not just work, but communities and downtown and suburbs? All of these things could be set to change. You know, and then the second issue is a lot about future skills, which we need to change much more quickly than we have in the past. And then finally, there's this idea about how do we get as disciplined about designing work as we are about designing IT systems? Or another way to put it is, how can we get as disciplined about designing human experience in work as we are about technology? Because we really think that that's the key to productivity for the future, but also just a more human way of working for people in the future.
you know, it's, I always find it interesting, you know, that, and I talk about it in my book, you know, people talk about people are the core, people are this, people are that. But, you know, the reality is, as you probably realize as well, is most people are unhappy at their work. And, you know, does anybody actually know what I'm doing? How does my work relate to my compensation? Do I feel comfortable that I work with a group of people that are admirable and everything else? Do I understand how people get promoted? Oh, well, you know, Bob got promoted, you know, and I work with a number of corporations. Well, probably not as many as you do, or not as diverse, but it's interesting that the conversation about talent and the utilization of it is still just pandered to, because they don't want to make the big decisions around that, the impact to organizations. Maybe you could talk about how impactful what organization, you know, maybe not impactful, but what they're facing today. Because the best thing about today, in my mind, is there's nobody says, though, that'll never work. You know, and you know yourself, growing up in an organization, there was always someone, a friend of mine calls them cave people, citizens against virtually everything. And there are always those people in the organization, right? But those people have been banished to the hinterland because nobody knows what'll work, right?
Yeah, you know, one of the things you're causing me to reflect upon is it's very easy for us as business leaders to think about the risk of action. We're constantly thinking about our stakeholders, our shareholders, or the citizens we represent, you know, depending on the business that we operate. And we often forget about the risk of inaction, which can be just as significant, if not more significant, than the risk of action. And you're right. There's something about COVID that has really highlighted that. I mean, just look at what governments have done. Really astonishing. To roll out programs like CERB in the timeframe that they did, if you'd asked somebody before the pandemic if that was possible, they would have said, forget about it. That sounds like a universal basic income. That'll take a decade. And they did it in weeks. And when some of those things do go wrong for organizations, it is very much about that not being able to balance the risk of action with the risk of inaction. But when you're in a crisis, suddenly decision-making becomes clearer. I've had lots of clients notice that through their own crises. It might have been smaller than these. So this is one of the questions we're asking is, how do you maintain some of what your organization has learned through this crisis? And teach them how to do some of it when there's no crisis.
Yes, yes, yes. I have a client and they always talk about, they say, we do crisis well. What we don't do well is day to day. And I think about when all the banks immediately dropped all the call centers. And those call centers have probably been studied for 50 years about whether to keep them or not. And I said to one of my clients, now in retrospect, how stupid was it to have people in from Barrie and Newmarket to take an hour and a half train ride in, to sit in a cubicle, to answer the phone, to take another hour and a half train ride home. So how do you help companies out of they don't know what they don't know? If you think about the world of knowledge having three pieces, I know what I know, I know what I don't know, but I don't know what I don't know, and I don't know how to get myself out of that bubble to figure it out, right? They have to trust someone. And you're talking in a world that doesn't exist.
It doesn't. You know, I've got colleagues outside of Deloitte who've been in the future of workspace. And, you know, it's funny to your point, back in 2011, 2012, 2013, it was a small world. And some of them would make pretty bold predictions and they'd try and go to like 2035. I never really did that. What I would do is look at the trail of a technology. And I actually take advantage of a thinker named Marshall McLuhan, a pretty famous Canadian, right?
Yes.
And I'd say, well, look, the medium is the message. So eventually this technology is going to take off and do what it intends to do. The cell phone's a great example. People forget that it's been around since the 80s. Remember the big clunky thing as big as your head?
Right?
Yeah. It took two decades to go from that to the cell phone as a business machine. So it was easy. It happened. There were people who looked at the cell phone as it was when it started and went, oh, if I think about what it is and what it's saying to us, I think I know what it's going to mean. That's all we do in the future of workspace. We take these trend lines. And the only debate is when it's going to happen, not if it's going to happen. You know, there's a discipline to that. You can teach leadership teams to use scenarios, to use technology trends, to paint a picture about what it might be like in 5 years and set their strategy to that. And by the way, Jim, if you could do that, why wouldn't you? Talk about risk avoidance. If you're trying to set the path for a big, complex organization without a view as to what the year with the future 5 years from now might look like, I call that a risk.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. One of my podcasts, I talked about the risk of not making the decisions being much greater, and that in general, people have a tendency to want to fix something that's broken, but they don't understand the real potential of making something way better that's just okay. And I think it's a human nature thing. And, you know, I have 6 kids and God knows, do you have kids?
I have 4 boys.
Oh, yeah, 4 boys. Oh, God bless your wife. She's going to get a Learjet to heaven. I grew up with 4 boys. Any woman that's got 4 boys deserves a Learjet to heaven, I'll tell you. And you can tell her from me. But I have brought up my children and my own principles, the ones that I believe in. And, you know, when I think about education, I think about how we're reinforced, you know, throughout life, we're reinforced to, you know, you're really good at that, Stephen. Don't spend any more time on that. You know, work on the things that you're not very good at. And I have a newfound respect for the Montessorial process, which sort of lets you develop. But inherently, the generation, I'm much older than you, but the generation that are in charge now are more afraid of being criticized for making a decision and don't feel the same responsibility for not making the decision. You can't fire me because I wasn't, you know, smart enough to think about doing something, but you can fire me if I do something and if it doesn't work out. How do you change that paradigm? How do you help people understand that?
Well, I mean, I think one of the most important things to do is to paint a picture of the future that people want to buy into. And by the way, there's a historical fallacy here that I find really interesting when it comes to the future of work. I've been on panels where people will say, oh, but Stephen, there's been 3 other industrial revolutions and it's always worked out. So why even bother? It's going to work out. There'll be new jobs. But what they're forgetting is, and this is true of this historical fallacy every time, whether you apply it to industrial revolutions or wars or political movements, things only turned out that way because leaders made decisions. And it is up to us to decide what we want the future of work to look like for Canada. And for me, what that means is we need to take work and take a hard look at it. Man, imagine you take a job, any job, you put it up on a canvas, like a painting, and you say, okay, that's what it looks like today, warts and all. What if we got rid of the dull work, the expensive work, the dangerous work? And wherever we could, we automated it. And where we couldn't do that, we gave it to people that don't want our damn full-time jobs, that are starting to more and more come into the gig economy. And what's left? Well, what's left is a much more interesting job, much more interesting work, much more human work. And then we can work backwards and figure out if that's the work we want, what technology do we need to make that work true? We do it backwards, Jim. We start with the technology, and then we try and figure out how the humans need to change to suit the technology. And that's one of the reasons why I think we've seen productivity stagnating at a time where, ironically, we're investing more in technology than we have historically ever done before. So we need to put the humans first again. That's the key.
I totally agree. I mean, you get no argument from me. So when you look at the breadth, and you know, I don't have to know who your clients are. When you look at the breadth, because I want my listeners to be able to, after you answer this question, to say to themselves, aha, that's where I am on that spectrum, right? That's where I am on that spectrum. Share with me, if you can, the sort of spectrum of where your clients are and what are the characteristics of the ones that are at the forefront and the ones that have sort of gotten their heads in the sands. Are there any sort of generalities about the different pockets that will hopefully, as you speak, will help my listeners sort of go, yeah, that's us right there. Or wow, we're way over here, you know?
Yeah. So there are sort of 3 categories. And by the way, you could use these 3 categories in any period. to describe an organization, but in COVID, it becomes crystal clear. I'd say there are a set of organizations that are still reacting. You know, it's almost like they're watching the news and they're watching their competitors and they just, what's next? And then when they hear what's next, they go and they try and react to it. And of course, being reactive is a very difficult place to be. By the way, we're all in that mode in March and April when COVID began. There's another group that are surviving. And by that, I mean, they've figured out some way to reconstitute their business. I'll give you an example. I was amazed at this. There's a pool supply store here in Ottawa that was suffering. They had huge demand, but they kept getting shut down. And so they were trying to figure out how to keep their business going. And I was amazed to see that within a period of weeks, they'd set up automated chatbot on their website. They were smart enough to realize that a lot of these technologies have become really cheap and cheerful. And if they just kind of applied their brains, they could figure out how to do this thing that some big employers are really struggling to do. So they really created this dynamic way for people to connect with them, ask questions, and it kept their business going. And that's great survival. And then the third category, and this is the rarer category, it's where we all want to get to, is organizations that have pivoted from survive to figuring out how they're going to thrive
right
in the new normal. I call on the new normal specifically here. These are the organizations that have thought not just how are we going to get to when vaccines are done, but days and months after that, this is how we're going to operate. And you know, that's the minority of organizations right now. And I think that's a big challenge for many of us to wrap our heads around.
Well, you know, it's funny because you talk about pivot and adapt, and I talk about it all the time in my podcasts and in my coaching practice. But, you know, that sort of pivot and adapt, I feel like you're in my mission somewhat differently, but with the same sort of goal in mind, is to give people courage. Give them courage to take that next step, right? And find out, you know, is it water or is it ground, you know? And you know, Canadians aren't what I would call courageous by nature. And so finding that leader, I suspect, that comes to you and says, I don't know what I don't know. I know that I'm in the wrong spot. They basically turn themselves over to you, right? And so one of the questions that I have is, when you take clients on, do you say to yourself, these people are never going to make it? They don't have any of the ingredients to make it. And so it's a waste of our time. I mean, I do. I'll tell you quite honestly. I look them in the eye. And first of all, they usually have a lot of courage to take me on as a coach, because I have a tendency to give it to them right between the eyes. So that's usually the first hurdle that I look for. Do you find that yourself?
I actually don't, Jim. I think this opportunity that we've been discussing is for everyone. And what we usually spend a lot of time doing with clients at the outset is figure out, where can we start? And I don't care if you're a very conservative client, I don't care how incremental it is, but where can we start? It's that whole, you know, journey of 1,000 steps thing. We'll get that first one done and we'll figure out where we're going to go to after that.
Or the night of 1,000 knives, whichever you prefer. but anyway, so the next question I have for you is, I remember years ago, I can't remember, it must have been early 2000s, I met a guy that worked for the province of Ontario. Honest to God, I can't remember what the capacity was. It might've been Belfield, it might've been somewhere. And he told me his job was the future of learning, but not as in future of skills like yourself, future of work. His job was to figure out what courses you needed for the futures. Are you working on that with the education system? And that, forget about the future of work and everything else. That must be even more mind-blowing, trying to come up with curriculums for subjects that don't even exist, for companies that don't even exist, right?
You know, I mean, again, I look to the technology ecosystem. If I bet you and I in a few minutes could chart out some of the skills of the future. Like, think about quantum computing, for an example. We all know it's coming. It's absolutely coming. And can we create curriculum to teach people about quantum computing today? We absolutely can. It's a more soluble problem than people think it is. And it's funny, in the skills space, a lot of clients will come to me and say, I got this Harvard article, or I got this thing from the World Economic Forum that says, here are the top 10 skills. But they don't say the same thing. Which one's right? And I'll say neither. Those are great lists to instigate ideas, but what you should do is sit down and say, in terms of our strategy, where are we going to play? How are we going to win? And once you answer those questions, I'll ask you, okay, what skills do you need for that strategy? And then exactly who needs to learn them? And then what are our build, buy, and borrow strategies to get those skills into people? Because we're not going to train everybody on everything every time. In some cases, we might need to borrow Jim, bring him into our team. While he's working with us, our people will learn from him, and then Jim will go away again, right? Like, it's pretty fundamental stuff, but it's most organizations don't have a plan at that level, that sort of talent strategy level plan for how they're going to do it.
There's no question that they don't. It must be pretty scary for some people to have you in.
I hope it's not. No, it's a good point, Jim. I hope it's not.
I don't mean scary because of you, but when you educate people outside their bubble and you force them to think differently, you obviously have that gene. I have that gene. I've always looked at everything and gone, wait a second, I don't want to look at it like this. I want to turn it over. I want to turn it inside out. You know, I can't say why, and you probably can't say why either. But some people have that lens and other people don't have that lens. But to people that have spent a lifetime of dealing in the here and now, God, when you sit in front of them, they must have two things. One, I have no idea what he's talking about. And then two, this is really scary how far we have to get.
Yeah, I will say, I always love that William Gibson quote, which is that the future is here, just not evenly distributed.
Exactly.
And that's true in both directions, right? Like, it's funny how often I'll work with a client and we'll come up with a really bold plan for how part of the organization can move forward. But then I'll know at the same time, they're going to be running AS400s for the next 5 years because they have to. So there's this unevenness to how people are going to experience this future of work. But, you know, there are things that scare me, Jim. Like, when you dig deeper into the future skills question, just imagine for a minute, and I know there are friends of mine that are in this business that have always had hardware domain expertise as their main job. So, you know, I kid with them. I say, oh, you stack servers and wiggle cables for a living, right? Yeah, well, that's part of it. There's more to it. But now we're moving everything to the cloud.
Yeah.
So when we say future skills, we don't just mean incremental. In some cases, we mean fundamental, because those folks are going to have to learn infrastructure as code. And there are going to be some people that are going to look at that and go, I've been doing this for 20 years. I don't want to learn infrastructure as code. Or I want to and I can't. And I spend a lot of my time worrying about how do we design this, both for our economy, but for our employers as well, so people don't get left behind in these transitions.
So, Stephen, the last thing I'd ask you to do is, because I try to leave my audience with something to think about and do the following week. So if you were sitting in front of the audience and it's my clients and some are CEOs, some are people, what are the three things you want them to think about and take action upon?
Well, I'll round it out where I began. I think seriously about how you want people to work in the future and overcome this. You know, it's ironic how often senior teams will say to me, but how do I know my people will be productive if they're spending some of their time not in my office? And I'll break it to them. There were a ton of people in your office that weren't
productive. Exactly.
So try to get over some of those mindset shifts and think about it differently. And then once you do, the possibilities are endless. You could start hiring anybody anywhere. You know, it just opens new opportunities for competitiveness. And then, you know, try to empower your people to learn. You know, it's amazing how people at home can figure out Twitter, figure out, you know, how to repair their barbecue by watching a YouTube video. Then you put them in an office and they say, oh, no, I can't do that. I haven't been trained yet. So really encourage your people to think about that differently and empower them. Maybe you let them go off and learn things any way they want to. And as an employer, you hold the examination bar and say, when you can jump over this, you're ready to go. And then finally, take time to think about how work can change, work itself. And that's another area where you'd be surprised. A lot of the sessions I run, we bring employees in to solve that challenge.
Oh, for sure. I always say the truth of an organization is in the body of the organization. It's not at the top. They know what's being wasted and what can be done better and everything else.
Yeah. And there's a way in that wisdom, Jim, to get beyond threat. Because when we have this conversation constantly just about how technology is going to change work, Everybody's threatened. I'm threatened. When you sit down with a group of workers and you say to them, what in your job is dull or repetitive or transactional? They'll start a list for you.
Oh, for sure. In a heartbeat, right?
And some of them, they'll say, when can you do something about that one? It changes the conversation.
Let me do more of the stuff I'm really good at, right?
Right.
That's fantastic. Stephen, I could go on for hours. And thank you very, very much. Again, everybody, it's Stephen Harrington from Deloitte. The future of work, the future of skills, the future of our lives. And you can't put your head in the sand and not worry about it. So to coin Stephen's phrase, get educated and keep educating yourself. Thanks, everybody. My name's Jim Bakey. The podcast is Be You, The World Will Adjust.